NASA announced last week that the ozone hole is slightly smaller than it was last year, continuing a long-term trend of shrinking over the past few years. In the 1980s, scientists announced that the world was on track to deplete the ozone layer of the atmosphere, which protects the Earth and the people who live on it from dangerous ultraviolet or UV rays. If you haven't heard about the hole in the ozone layer for a while, that's in part because the world took some action and it stopped growing. Some environmental experts say that effort could be a model for the effort to slow down climate change. Tracy Holloway is professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, scientists working in Antarctica started noticing this hole in the ozone layer in the 70s. Can you take us back to the 70s and 80s and what we were figuring out, what was going wrong?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. Back in the 1970s, they realized that certain chemicals had the potential to deplete the protective ozone layer up in the stratosphere. And this is the layer of the atmosphere that filters UV light. It kind of acts like a natural sunblock. So in the 1970s, they were concerned that over the long term, this could be a problem. And actually, they put in place some early preventive initiatives. But then in 1985, everyone was so surprised to actually see a big hole forming over Antarctica, because until 1985, it had been perceived as more of a slow and steady change that we would expect. And it was really put the atmospheric science community in an uproar in 1985 with the discovery of this hole. And it was discovered by a team of British scientists. Then a U.S. expedition went down led by Susan Solomon, who is now a professor at MIT. And then they went back through archived satellite data, which they had thrown away digitally because they thought it was so crazy. And then they went back and saw that actually satellites had been seeing it since the 1970s. They just didn't know it. And so really, it was discovered all of a sudden in 1985, and 2 years later, there was a binding international treaty to control the chemicals that caused the ozone hole, and that was known as the Montreal Protocol.
Could you talk a little bit about those chemicals, the CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons? They were in refrigerants. They were in like Aquanet, the official hairspray of the early 1980s, as I recall. What is this class of chemicals? Why were they so harmful?
Yeah. So, you know, at the time they were considered miracle chemicals because they were so stable that they could go into fires and be used in fire extinguishers. They could be used in electronics, air conditioning, refrigeration, even, you know, asthma inhalers. They were used to deliver the medicine. So they were so stable that they didn't pose an immediate risk to humans, which was good. But the bad news is they were so stable, they just hung around the atmosphere until they mixed slowly but surely up to the upper layer of the atmosphere, the stratosphere, and then they were zapped with high energy radiation from the sun. And this high energy radiation broke them apart in ways that people didn't predict ahead of time. And that set off a chain of chemical reactions. And it's very interesting because even one of these CFC molecules can destroy thousands upon thousands of ozone molecules because the molecule gets sort of destroyed and recreated while the ozone is just destroyed.
Let's get back to that timeline. You mentioned 1987, the Montreal Protocol. 2 years after this was discovered as an urgent threat, what happened? What did this protocol, the cooperation, look like?
Yeah, so countries from around the world, including the United States, signed on to this protocol, which pledged to ramp down the use of chlorofluorocarbons. And in some cases, it was replacing these with other chemicals. In some cases, it was changing the process. But basically, they were just swapping in chemical substitutes. So we all still use air conditioning. We all still use our refrigerators. It's just that the chemicals, you know, behind the scenes have changed out.
We're talking to Tracy Holloway from UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, looking at efforts to stop the spread of an ozone hole and how they've worked over time. And Tracy, could you talk about the long-term impact? Now, here we are, 2022. How much impact has that Montreal Protocol had?
Yeah, it's really been a success story because once the decision was made to limit these CFCs, countries signed on, technologies were adopted, and the emissions, the release of these chemicals into the atmosphere dropped off precipitously. Now we're emitting almost nothing. However, the chemicals that were released back in the day are still floating around in the upper atmosphere. And that's the problem. They have an average lifetime of about 50 years, some much longer. And so we have to wait for the ozone hole to catch up to the policies from the 80s and the early 90s. It is getting better. It's shrinking slowly but surely each year. And that's because the damaging chemicals are going down bit by bit each year.
Now, one of the replacement chemicals, HFCs, are, like CFCs, I think, also a greenhouse gas. So we're looking at, a second step of solutions here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I often talk in my classes at UW-Madison about these three different problems, the ozone hole, climate change, and, you know, air quality, like the air pollution that makes us sick. And for the most part, these are three different questions and have three different problems and different chemicals and different policy solutions, but they overlap in interesting ways. And CFCs that destroyed the ozone layer are actually also greenhouse gases. So without really trying to, the Montreal Protocol also was a step forward in addressing climate change because it phased out an important category of greenhouse gases. Now, unfortunately, the replacement HFCs are good for ozone, but still bad for climate. So, you know, we're still looking for what's that next step, what's that next issue on the horizon. But the biggest issue for climate change is carbon dioxide. And the good news is we have a lot of different ways to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Do you think that the Montreal Protocol could be a model for international cooperation on climate change and those carbon dioxide emissions you were just talking about?
I think that it has a lot of lessons that can be applied to the climate problem. One, the good news story. And sometimes it's easy to focus on how difficult a problem is, but we see from the Montreal Protocol, the policy was signed in 1987. That was a turning point and things are getting better slowly, but we are on the path to recovery. And I think that that's the right mindset to have around climate change. We have to turn the corner. And once we turn the corner, it's not like everything will go back to the old climate of the last 30 years, but we're on the track to making things better.
Do you worry that there could be a sense of defeatism with a big problem like climate change that we need, you know, a good news story like the ozone hole efforts to remind us that we can make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's important to recognize the problem, because if you don't acknowledge the problem, it's hard to start thinking about a solution. But if there's no hope, then it's hard for people to get to rally behind actually getting something done. And when it comes to climate change, there's a lot of reasons for hope. We have so many great solutions ready to go. As soon as there's the policy in place to mandate these solutions, just like there was for the climate, for the ozone hole, I think that the solutions will, you know, come off the shelf and be deployed. I'll just note that actually the ozone hole isn't the only big success story. Another good one is the Clean Air Act of 1970. Once that was passed, our air started getting cleaner and cleaner and our life expectancy started going up. So we have success stories, and I am optimistic that, you know, we can make climate change a success story as well.
In just our last minute or so, you mentioned solutions waiting on the shelf for the will to use them. What would be your top priority when it comes to a climate change solution?
I think that the sort of the two-pronged solution is to move our electricity system to zero carbon and try to move all of our energy use to electricity, because if we're having cars and home heating and other sources that tend to be electric, and then we have a clean electric grid, that's the 1-2 punch we need to solve climate change.
Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She talked to us about what it's taken to keep the ozone hole from growing after NASA announced that it shrank again in 2022.